Tony is from Berkeley. He's been there for 25 years, and he's going to talk to us about his latest book, Dodging Extinction. He has another book that came out a few years ago called Heatstroke that we're going to use in the work that we're doing for Long Beach on dealing with climate change. And he has another book coming out sometime the latter part of this year called Endgame. He grew up in Colorado, in Pueblo, Colorado. He got his bachelor's degree at Colorado College, and then he worked for the coal industry and on the Alaska pipeline. He owes everything to the fossil fuel industry. Maybe not.
There's a history there.
And then he went to the University of Washington, and he got a master's and a PhD from the University of Washington. There are seats up front here. Paleontologist, paleoecologist, what are all the other?
That's good enough.
All of those. And he's a professor. He is he does research in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology, professor of integrative biology, the curator of fossil mammals in the Museum of Paleontology. And he spent decades doing research on paleontology in the last few years, bringing a lot of those results to the general public in some very important books. And tomorrow at noon, he's going to talk to us about how some of these ideas fit into what we're doing with our Pacific visions, because dodging extinction is a big part of that story. And if any of you saw the reports that were in the New York Times and Washington Post and on most of the TV stations a couple of weeks ago, based on a science article that appeared January the 16th about mass extinction in the ocean, and it might that we had about 20 years to take action. They unfortunately chose, not the newspapers, but science, I think that the authors chose a very poor title, Defaunation of the Ocean. Most people had no idea what the heck it meant. But the New York Times.
All the big things die.
So please join me in welcoming Anthony to the aquarium.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be able to talk tonight and was really honored by the invitation, so thank you very much. Couple of messages I'll just get out there right up front, okay? Number one is no longer are we part of nature, we are a real force of nature, equivalent to what causes the world to go from, say, an ice age to the warm time that we're in that civilization developed in. Even equivalent to what killed the dinosaurs, okay? So that's one thing to take with you. And the other is we changed the planet dramatically. And I always like this picture because anybody know what these guys are, what the profession is? These guys are called high scalers. And they're the reason that 18 million people can live in this part of the world. These are the guys who went into places like Glen Canyon and built the dams on the Colorado that end up providing water to this part of the world. Just shows you what people can do when they put their mind to it. These guys are hanging off sheer cliffs with jackhammers in 130-degree heat, eventually building a dam that allows us to live here, okay? So we changed the planet not only like that, but many other ways. I mean, if we talk about dams, we've actually dammed 60% of the large rivers in the world. The other thing I want to drive home is that people are really clever. When we know there's a big problem, we tend to want to fix it, and we tend to figure out how to fix it. And that is exactly where we stand today with extinctions. We are in an extinction crisis, but in fact, we have the wherewithal and we kind of know what needs to be done to get out of it. There's a couple of big things standing in our way. One is most people don't understand the gravity of the situation, which is a big reason I wrote this book. And the other is that when they do understand the gravity of the situation, the immediate response is, oh, that's such a big problem, we can't do anything about that. But this picture, this is Lonesome George. Anybody know who Lonesome George is? Okay, Lonesome George, this picture was actually taken about 11 months before he died. Lonesome George was the last tortoise of his subspecies of Galapagos tortoises. There are several other subspecies as well. The whole species almost died out. They were down to 500 years ago, it's estimated there were 250,000 plus or minus Galapagos tortoises out there in the world. By the early part of the last century, 2,000 left. Mid part of the last century, the government of Ecuador said, we don't want to see these things disappear forever. And conservation measures were put in place. Population is now built back up to 9,000 individuals. They're still not totally out of the woods, but going in the right direction. So, that's an example. When we want to do something, when we want to bring species back, we can usually figure out a way to do it. And this is a little baby tortoise of a different subspecies of Galapagos tortoise. And with, among the things that are done to bring that species back are collecting the eggs from where they're laid, bringing them to incubation chambers, raising the babies till they're of this age or somewhat larger, and then returning them to the wild. And now, actually, I just saw in the newspaper a couple of weeks ago that in many of these places where baby tortoises had not been hatching and surviving, they're doing it. So they're on the way back, and as long as we keep going, they're going to make it. So, as Jerry said, I got into this extinction business through paleontology, so I tend to take the long view. And the long view is extinction is a pretty normal thing. It's a very normal thing. It's a lot like, a person is born, has a lifespan, dies. Species go through that progression, too. We call that extinction. So there's a background rate of extinction. The big problem now is that so many species are going extinct so fast that we're far exceeding that background rate. And that's where we start thinking about mass extinction. So we know that from paleontological studies where we've gone out to rocks like this, and we collectively, paleontologists all over the world, have amassed literally millions of fossil specimens, put those in databases. We know the first appearance, the last appearance of thousands of species in time. From that, we can then calculate out what's that normal birth-death rate of species and come up with an extinction rate. And just for mammals, which is the best data we have, basically that normal background extinction rate is about 2 species per million species per year, which means that if you have a million species out there, you might expect to see 2 of them go extinct in a year, okay? So that's normal based on the fossil record. Now we have 5,500 mammal species on the planet today, so we might expect that over the last 100 years, we should have seen 1 of those go extinct, given that normal rate of extinction. What we actually saw was 43. So for mammals, extinction rate is 43 times too high. All right, it's not just mammals. The IUCN, which is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, takes it upon themselves to go out and assess how much trouble species are in. Now, ideally, we'd like to do that for all the species on Earth, but with just 1.9 million named species, not to even mention the other 7 or 8 million that aren't named, if you start doing the math, you find that in order to assess all of those species, it would take about 300, 400 years, okay? We're not there yet. We've assessed about 75,000, which is a good number, but only 4%. Of those 75,000, about 25,000 are known to be vulnerable to extinction, okay? So if things kept going the way they're going, they're gone. So about a third of the species we know anything about. That's a big number. So that's the bad news, and if you kept carrying that out, within 2 to 3 human lifetimes, we would be at what paleontologists recognize as a mass extinction. Mass extinction to a paleontologist is something like what happened when the dinosaurs got wiped off the face of the earth, okay? At least 3 out of every 4 species that you are familiar with disappear. So think about a mass extinction, your kids look out the window, and 3 out of the 4 living things that you take for granted are gone. That's a mass extinction. So this is my extinction-o-meter here, where we go from 0% extinct species to 100%. And that vertical black line represents the mass extinction, all those little icons down at the bottom here, show you the percentages of species that went extinct during past mass extinctions. We know this has happened 5 times over the past 500 million years, so we know mass extinctions are real phenomena, they happen. And as far as the percentages of species in various categories that are threatened with extinction today, that is on the IUCN threatened list, you know, we have mammals at 22%, birds at 14%, and so on. Most of those plants and animals that we know anything about, somewhere between, say, 15 and 60% threatened, all right? Now, that's the bad news. Here's the good news, though. Those white symbols on the screen here show you how many have actually gone extinct. What percentage of species that have ridden the planet with us for the past 12,000 years have we actually caused to go extinct? That's less than 1%. What that means is that almost all of what we want to save in the way of keeping species on Earth are still out there to be saved. But they're in big trouble. So saving species, you know, people care about saving species when they know that species are in trouble. We're willing to take some really extreme measures to do it. I took this picture in South Africa last summer, and you're out there driving around, and your guide takes you up to, you know, these amazing animals, and looks like they're just out there doing what they do. And then our guide said, well, what you can't see is there's a guy with an automatic weapon out there in the bushes. These guys are under 24/7 armed guard. Every rhinoceros in South Africa is under 24/7 armed guard because that horn is worth about $300,000 to a poacher. There's a shoot-to-kill policy on poachers. So those are the extreme measures that people are actually willing to take when they know there's a problem, all right? You can imagine, though, if we let all of those 25,000 species get down to the dwindling numbers that those rhinos are at, or that many other species are at, there aren't all the resources in the world to keep them on Earth. So the point is, we don't want to let all of those threatened species get in as bad shape as rhinos. So how do we keep that from happening? That's where you have to start thinking about addressing the root causes of the problem rather than doing it on a piecemeal species by species basis. And right here are the root causes of the problem, okay? Basically, it goes back to there's an awful lot of people on the planet, and we use an awful lot of the planet for ourselves. I'll show you. We use 50% of the land for ourselves. It takes 50%, half the planet, out of play for other land-dwelling species. Okay, so human population, we already have 7.5 billion of us, or 7.2 billion. So as we move into the future, we know there's only going to be more and more people. Best case scenario is we're going to level out at about 10 billion. Well, sorry, best case scenario is we're going to drop back to about 7 billion. But on the way to that, we're going to hit 9 to 10 billion at the year 2050, which is where that gray arrow is pointing on the graph. We know that from demographic models. Even if we very soon, that is over the next few years, fertility, birth rates dropped to replacement rate in countries where they're not already at replacement rate, and then stayed there, we would rise to about 10 billion, then it would level off at 10 billion. Half a child more than replacement rate, we're up at what, about 16 billion. If we kept doing things just as we have for the past decade, by the year 2100, we would have 27 billion people on the planet, and that ain't going to happen, I guarantee you. So I think the reality we have to live with, if we're talking about keeping these threatened species on Earth, is, okay, how do we do that and still add 2 to 3 billion more people to the planet? Okay, because when we do that, we're going to be increasing the needs of the human race. We're going to be increasing energy needs. We're going to be causing more habitat loss. If we keep doing things the way we have, we'll see that climate will be changing as a result of how we produce energy. We have this issue of regarding nature as this inexhaustible resource over exploitation for money, and it all adds up to extinction. So addressing those root causes is absolutely key. And you can kind of boil them down to three categories, all right? Power, food, and money, which is why the subtitle of the book is Power, Food, and Money. And I'll walk you through each of these, but basically power is how do we produce the energy we need to keep the human race doing what we like to do without having a backlash that causes all these other species to go extinct. Food. How do we actually produce enough food to feed 10 billion people in the world when the way we're doing it now is not only causing other species to go extinct, but is not even doing the job? 1 in 7 people are hungry every day, okay? There's about 1 billion hungry people in the world that don't get enough to eat. How do we fix that? And then money, I alluded to that already. How do we shift our economic thinking so that nature is an investment bank rather than an inexhaustible checking account in our mind? Big task. Can we do it? Let's think about this, okay? I'm just going to walk through these one by one. So power. We're really kind of between a rock and a hard spot when it comes to energy, and actually more of a rock and a hard spot than most people realize, and I'll show you why. If you think about all the species in the world, that's the global ecosystem, right? And it takes energy to power that global ecosystem. All species have to eat, obtain energy somehow. Before people ever got into the act, the only energy source available, sun, its plants, converts it into, takes that heat energy, converts it into chemical energy, i.e. photosynthesis, and then animals eat the plants, animals eat each other, so that energy cycles through the system, all right? The total amount available, because that photosynthesis thing is a bottleneck, is that number you see there, 728 exajoules. Exajoule is just a great big measure of energy. To give you a sense of how big, the earthquake in Japan in 2011, which caused the worldwide tsunamis, destroyed 3 nuclear plants, Anybody want to guess how many exajoules of energy that released? Sorry? 20. That's about 20 times more than it released. 1.4 exajoules, all right? So we're talking about a lot of energy there. Okay, so that's what's available from in the normal circumstance. Today we take about a third of that for ourselves. So that's a fixed pie. If we take a third, that's other species lose that third. So that explaining some of that loss of species we've seen. But that's not enough. That's nowhere near enough for us. Every year, the human race uses more energy than can be produced by photosynthesis under natural circumstances. Okay? Where do we get the extra? I think you know that. We actually mine that fossil photosynthesis, if you will, out of the ground. Fossil fuels. We produce about 550 exajoules to make up the difference. And that's what allows 7 billion people and the animals that support us to stay on Earth, okay? So now here's why I say, here's the rock and the hard spot. We have to produce 550 exajoules of energy or billions of people die. That white circle is you can view it as the total biomass of big animals on Earth. That is, take all the big animals on Earth and put them on a scale and weigh them. That white circle is how many big animals could be supported if there wasn't extra energy produced. The orange circle are 7 billion human bodies, and the purple circle adds on our cows and pigs and all that. So basically, we produce 550 exajoules a year, or lots of things die. That's why I say we're between a rock and a hard spot. Okay, we can't just quit producing energy. All right, well, now we all know the problem, right? Because the way we're producing that energy, the way we've traditionally produced it, is actually changing climate dramatically. And you know, when I, almost invariably when I give a talk about climate change, somebody says, yeah, but isn't climate change normal in the Earth's history? You know, you're a paleontologist, you've seen climate change. And here's my answer to that. Absolutely. It's very normal for climate to change in Earth's history. As you know, this little depiction shows you, you've got those wiggles that go on the million-year time scale here, and then you can look at it on a finer time scale over 250,000 years, and that's the kind of wiggles you get in the climate. Just view that line as sort of average global temperature. If you look over 100 years, you know, there's some little wiggles there. But now if you look over the last 50 years, we're going way outside the range of normal. And not only that, we're going there really, really fast, and we're going to a brand new normal. So the species that are on Earth don't have the evolutionary capacity to cope with that speed and amount of change. And they've never experienced that speed and amount of change in their evolutionary history, okay? Another way to look at this is, if we look over the past 600 million years, all of the time that complex life has been on Earth, temperature on Earth has varied about 10 degrees Celsius, so what, 18 degrees Fahrenheit. If you look at what's happening from where we are now to where we're headed, and we are on this red trajectory, if you look at that amount of change, that's about 6 degrees Celsius, which means that in 50 to 100 years, we're cranking up the thermometer almost, well, more than halfway of how much it's varied over the past 600 million years, okay? So species have trouble with that. Plants and animals have trouble with that. Here's the kind of trouble. If you're talking about a rainforest, which right now rainforests contain somewhere between half to two-thirds of the land-dwelling species, crank up temperature 4 to 6 degrees Celsius, and you end up going from something that looks like the picture on the left to the picture on the right. Lots of changes for the birds, mammals, amphibians, lizards that live in those landscapes. If you think about the oceans, a knockoff effect of putting CO2 in the atmosphere is making the oceans more acidic. Most ocean-dwelling creatures have trouble when water's chemistry changes that much. There have been studies done, very credible studies, that point out that if we kept going on the trajectory we're going with ocean acidification, by the year 2070, there would be virtually no coral reefs left on Earth, okay? That wipes out 25% of the ocean species right there. So these are big problems, and these are root causes. Okay, and really there is only one way out on this. And I don't say that lightly because, you know, Jerry said my first job was as a coal geologist. It goes back farther than that. My grandfather, this guy right here, was a coal miner for 40 years. I mean, I got, you know, fossil fuels running in my veins. But that notwithstanding, here's the reality of the situation. If we don't want that amount of temperature rise and that amount of ocean acidification that I just pointed out to take place, we have to lower emissions across the board on fossil fuels by 5.1% per year, which is that green line, okay? That's where we need to get and stay as we go from now to 2050 and on into the future. So by 2050, 2060, we have to be on that green line trajectory. Now let's say we take the dirtiest fossil fuel, which is coal, and replace it with the cleanest fossil fuel. By the year 2030, so 15 years from now, get rid of every coal plant and replace it with a clean burning natural gas plant. We could cut emissions to that yellow line, but that still only gets us halfway. So that's why I say the only way out of the mess in terms of keeping other species alive is we have to get off of fossil fuels as fast as possible. And now everybody's rolling their eyes and saying, sure. Well, people have done, you know, they've done the numbers. And we have the technology pretty much in hand, not all the way, but pretty much. And just scaling up what we have would pretty much do the job with a few little additions. With what we know how to do today, if we built, you know, that many rooftop systems and that many wind turbines and that many hydroelectric plants and geothermal and so on, we could do it. And that's something we could do in the time period. Now, you look at those numbers. Those are big numbers. Yeah. All of these. We need to do all this. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So everything you see on the screen, we need to do. And you know, it looks like a lot. It is a lot. It's a big job. But when you think about could we really scale it up? Well, sure. Of course we could. I mean, we think about how many cars we produce in a year. It's like hundreds of millions worldwide. If you think about going from in World War II, you know, in the beginning of World War II, the United States didn't have any airplane factories. There were about 3,000 airplanes, maybe, in the U.S. 4 years later, conversion of automobile factories to airplane factories, there were 300,000 airplanes. So, you know, these are things that people can do. And what it takes, of course, is the will, the incentives, the carrots and the sticks to make it happen. That's the stationary energy system. That's only half the energy system. The other half is the transportation system. We kind of have that under control, too, if we scale it up. We've already got fully electric cars. anybody here got a Tesla? Ridden in one, at least? They're pretty cool. They're pretty cool. So, you know, you're not really making a sacrifice if the price comes down in terms of performance. Same thing with hydrogen cell technologies are now coming online to the point where prices can start coming down. There are hydrogen cell cars out there on the road being produced by Toyota. So again, thing to remember here, though, particularly with all electric cars, they're tightly linked to that stationary system. If you're driving a fully electric vehicle in Denver, Colorado, which produces most of its power on coal, you're getting the equivalent of about 34 miles a gallon. All right, it's not that big a savings. If you're driving one in California, where a lot of our power comes from cleaner sources, you're getting the equivalent of about 78 miles a gallon. So that link between the stationary and transportation system is very strong in that respect. Airplanes. I've got a brother who flew planes for the Navy and then was a commercial pilot for years and years and years. He just laughs at me when I say, you know, we got to go carbon neutral on airplanes. However, U.S. military doesn't laugh. Those planes, and as a matter of fact, the entire Pacific fleet was run for a day. We're talking aircraft carriers and airplanes. Run for a day on biofuels, just to show that it could be done. The military takes this very seriously and would like to get off of fossil fuels, and they're working at it. Now the problem, as we're going to see with biofuels, is if you use land that needs to be grown to feed people, to feed cars and airplanes, you got another big problem. However, algal-based biofuels are really showing a lot of promise at this point, and that's very likely the way of the future. okay, food. I mentioned we use about 51% of the land surface for ourselves. Of that 51%, about 40% is for food production, either farms or pasture land. Now, if you do the math, we've got about 7.2 billion people in the world now. You divide that by the acreage in food production, it takes about, you know, even though we like to say, oh, we live in a small house, we've got a small footprint, your ecological footprint is about 2 acres per person. Actually, yours is probably more, because that 2 acres per person is a worldwide average. Okay? So, if you project that into the future and add 2 billion, 3 billion more people, we're in trouble because we don't have enough arable land left to keep up at that pace. And most of that arable land are rainforests, which harbor 50 to 65% of all land-dwelling species. All right, so how do we produce enough in the places we're already growing food to feed all those additional hungry mouths, plus the billion that aren't getting fed already? Turns out there's some pretty straightforward solutions to this problem, again, if we do things differently. If it turns out most of the places we have in production for food now are not producing at maximum yield, and that's particularly true in much of Africa, which could produce 75% more food on the land under cultivation. So if we bring up production by using more efficient farming techniques, that produces 50 to 60% more food for the world. That goes a long way towards getting us out of the mess. Of course, that gets us into another mess if we do it the same way as we have been. And, you know, the reason the first green revolution worked is because we started to produce synthetic fertilizers, nitrogen, irrigate, and so on. But we didn't do that. We still haven't done it in a very efficient way. The basic technique is just to throw as much fertilizer as you can afford onto your field. Most of that gets washed into the watershed, down the rivers, out into the mouths of the rivers in the ocean. And all those red dots are dead zones all around the world's oceans because too much nitrogen, phosphorus, agricultural runoff increases nutrient loads, causes algal blooms. They die, suck all the oxygen out of the water, and nothing else can live there. So in order to increase production and do what we need to do, we have to also do it in an environmentally sound way, which, again, is possible by what the food security people like to call the Goldilocks strategy of, you know, not too little, not too much fertilizer, but just enough, minimal water, because we all know in California about water problems. But the point is, it's doable if we want to take the extra trouble to do it. Another easy thing, eat less meat. Turns out you lose calories every time you go up the food chain by feeding all that corn that goes to feedlot cattle directly to people. You actually increase the world's calories by some 50 to some estimates are 75%. I should say I like meat a lot too, because my dad was a butcher. So, you know, fossil fuels, meat. But I'm trying. Okay, easy fix here. A third of the food that's grown in the world is wasted. Developed countries goes into the trash can or off the supermarket shelf because it looks ugly. In the developing world, it's more of a distribution problem, getting it from field to mouths. So coming up with better food distribution systems and basically wasting less. All right, so let's move on to number three, the money part. You know, of course, people aren't expanding those farmlands as fast as they do, actually, because we need to do that. It's a lot quicker and cheaper to cut down another parcel of rainforest than it is to, you know, put in the monitoring systems and so on you need to do things efficiently where you're already farming. So this is a big reason that we're seeing habitat loss so fast. So by taking care of this food problem, we also take care of that habitat loss problem to a large extent. The other thing we do in the way of using the money issue is we use species and sell them for parts. and it's big money. I mean, one bluefin tuna, you guys probably already know this, right? One bluefin tuna in 2013 in the Tokyo fish auction went for $1.8 million. That's an expensive meal. You know, that's expensive sushi, $3,600 a pound. Now, interestingly, 2014, the price went way down to $70,000 for a similarly sized tuna. And what happened was basically price fixing. Okay, the tuna buyers got together and said, we really don't want to jack up the price that high this year. But still, $70,000 for a single fish is a lot of money. Same thing on land. You know, I mentioned rhino poaching. Same issues with elephant poaching. Tusks are used for basically ivory curios. The Asian markets have really picked up for that because more and more people are moving into more affluent economic classes and can afford those things, and it's a status symbol. To the extent that if poaching for tusks went on at the rate it has been for the past 4 or 5 years, there would be no more wild elephants left on Earth in 20 years, okay? That's startling to think about. The other thing about that particular problem is it's not, you know, the Africans in poverty out there on the ground that are making all the money. It's international drug rings and terrorist groups that are smuggling this ivory and actually running the whole show. So this really illustrates in a very graphic way how we think of nature, and you can scale this up to legal activities as well as illegal ones. We think of nature as just this inexhaustible bank account that we're never going to run out. Well, now we know we will, and if you start putting a price on that, all of a sudden the economics make zero sense. I mean, if we did get rid of all the elephants in 20 years, the poachers and drug gangs would end up pocketing $30 billion over that 20 years at today's prices. Over the same 20 years, though, just in one country, Kenya, the ecotourism industry, which is based on elephants and other animals in those natural ecosystems, would generate $120 billion. So, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer which one is the economically more viable strategy, but we tend not to think in those terms. And in fact, you can value all kinds of biodiversity and ecosystem services. People are just beginning to do this. You know, the world GDP is about $72 trillion. It's been calculated that ecosystem services, which we mainly don't pay for, are worth about $145 trillion a year. So finding ways to value those, integrate them into our world trading and economic systems would go a long way towards solving this problem. And, you know, we tend to think, oh, yeah, corporations are the bad guys. They're never going to do that. But, in fact, there are some very concerned CEOs out there that are trying to do just that. And this is a group called the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. These are the CEOs of the wealthiest corporations in the world, most of them anyway. You get to be in this organization because another CEO invites you, and you don't send a representative. It's the CEOs. They have developed a plan called Vision 2050, which is, this is 200 corporations, a subset of 29 have gotten together and developed this Vision 2050 plan. That's the motto, 9 billion people live well and within the limits of the planet by 2050. How do we do that? They've laid out milestones for the business world that include trading and ecosystem services, doubling agricultural output, you know, all these things we've been talking about. So the point being that people at the top actually are thinking about these issues, even though we tend to throw up our hands in despair. But that isn't enough, because it has to go both top down and bottom up. You know, I've seen a lot of action from the top down, actually, in recent years. In climate change, for example, I've been working on that issue for 2 decades. In the past 5 years, amazing strides, especially here in California. You know, I mean, this is Governor Brown signing an agreement with China directly. His view is Washington's broken. We're the 8th largest economy in the world. We can just work with China directly to fix this thing. And he is. Obama as well. Again, hamstrung, but and President Xi in China. My point being, the top is thinking about this. What they need now are signals from the bottom, that is us, which is, I don't think a lot of people are aware of this extinction problem. So the more, I'd say the biggest thing anyone in this room could do at this point, or a very big thing, is, you know, go home, talk to your friends, talk to your family. Make this an issue in your social circle, because that's how the bottom up starts to work. And that's what we really need to solve this problem. The other advice I'd give is don't give up. I mean, these things don't change overnight. You know, you tend to throw up your hands in despair, but this is a problem. All of these problems I've been talking about are things that have actually taken decades to develop, little by little by little. They're going to take a decade, two decades to turn around. So as soon as you give up, you know, you lose the fight. So you have to be persistent about this stuff. And we do have a very short window of time to make it happen. I'd say the estimate that Jerry mentioned for that science article that came out on the oceans, if we don't get it turned in the next decade or two, I think then we will see the sixth mass extinction inevitably. But we have this window of opportunity where we can really make a huge difference. You know, if you don't believe that, I'll just leave you with these examples of things that were every bit as big as what we're facing now. 1960s, it was virtually certain that if we didn't revamp the global agricultural system, a billion or more people would be dead by 1980 from starvation. What did that take? It took international cooperation. It took cooperation between scientists, business, NGOs. It took a few really dedicated people, like Norman Borlaug, to push it over the edge and to make things happen. But you know, these problems I've been talking about tonight, that's what they require, is international cooperation, working across the aisle, working government, economic systems, NGOs, and so on. It can happen. It has happened. Same thing with the Montreal Protocol in turning around the growth of the ozone hole, another international effort that worked. So I don't think it's time to throw up our hands in despair about this by any means. I think these sorts of examples and just the basic human ingenuity tell us that if we want to fix it, we can. So I'll just leave you with this thought. You know, we can, I mean, I've got a couple of kids, daughters that are grown pretty much now, but the things we really enjoyed doing and the things they enjoyed doing growing up are, you know, visiting wild places like this. We've got a choice. We can tackle these problems so that their kids can see these same things, or we can just kind of say, all right, let's just see what happens, and then just pluck 3 out of 4 of every one of those things you see there, and that will be their world. So I really do think the choice is ours. I really think we have it in the power to do it. And I hope we do. Thank you.